the majority of the action in First and Second Samuel takes place around the Central Highlands. I got some maps in here we can kind of look at. The nation of Israel is largely concentrated in the area, ran about 90 miles in the hill country of Ephraim, Judah. So we're going to see that it's very, very centralized, and we're going to see Shiloh is where the ark is. There, nothing's where we kind of picture it. When we go into the New Testament and Jerusalem's, this is kind of a spread out, and this is the birth of the kind of where we go from all these tribal lands to more of a kingdom that we're going to see that Gibeah was the headquarters of Saul, and Jerusalem, obviously, or Bethlehem becomes David, which will play a very, very big role in the Christmas story. And and David eventually ruled Jerusalem, became the center of David, city of David. So these things took place between 1105 BC, which is the birth, and around 971, which is the last words of David. So that's for the kind of ending of this little section. So the book spans about 135 years, and we'll see from a time of the judges that everybody kind of did what was right in their own eyes to a more closely knit, centralized monarchy. And they look primarily to Samuel as the beginning of that. He is the start of the nation coming together and listening to one voice who is, and it's interesting because if you look at it, as we see in our own country, as the leaders are corrupt, fewer and fewer people listen to the leaders. And it just becomes this hodgepodge, and we're going to see the corruptness, and you're honestly, sometimes we see it in our own society and all, but it seems like when God picks out a man for greatness, one of the first attacks is on his family. And we'll see many times here, great people, David does it, we're going to see Eli does it, they fail their sons, somehow. So, I know you have your own choices, and, you know, you could be the most Christian family in the world, and your kids are allowed to make their own choices, good or bad. But it seems to be, we see that a lot where kids are targeted by the enemy. So, anybody, did I miss anything? Is there anything anybody wants to fill in? Maybe I ain't. All right. Oh, so here I wanted to show you. So if you remember back to the book of Judges, I grabbed this map out of Judges. This is the land that was given on the right side. That was the land that was given to the tribes. What's on the left side is when the book of Samuel takes over. This is what they have. And I had to fit it in here. So you can see that little yellow all the way to the right. That's kind of the two humps there. But you can see Israel is literally being squeezed in a vice by its enemies. And you can understand why they're crying out for a king. And, you know, we always, you know, with the ability to look back, we always say, oh, they should have waited. You know, God was their king. But, you know, in human think they're being squeezed, and they're reacting as tribes and groups instead of a cohesive unit all the time. And I think in our earthly beings, we want to, you know, that group of people to help us protect ourselves and all that. It's a human reaction. So it's easy to, you know, look at it and say, oh, they were stupid, and it was a dumb thing to do, but you can kind of understand some of it. So then in this next slide, here is Jerusalem on this map. Here's Jerusalem on this map. And as you can see from Jerusalem to Gath on this map is about 2.5 inches. On this, it's probably 1. So you can see, so we're going to zoom in. This is where the birth of the nation is kind of going to become from this centralized area in the center of this. This little Ephraim, because you can see as the yellow part on the left here off the Mediterranean Sea, that's the Philistines pressuring them. And then you'll see that it's Moab, the Ammonites, other people from the east side of them pressuring them. And actually, Saul really doesn't defeat them all. David is the person eventually that will unite the kingdom. So I just copied this out of some, I don't remember where I got it. As 1 Samuel begins, Israel's at a low point spiritually. The priesthood was corrupt. The Ark of the Covenant was not in the tabernacle. Idolatry was practiced, and the judges were dishonest. Through the influence of godly Samuel and David, these conditions are reversed. 2 Samuel concludes with the anger of the Lord being withdrawn. During the years narrated 1 and 2, great empires, ancient world, were in a state of weakness. So neither Egypt, Mesopotamia, Babylon, or Assyria were threats to Israel. Two nations most hostile to Israel were the Philistines to the west and the Ammonites to the east. A major contingent of the Philistines had migrated from the Aegean Islands to Asia Minor in the 12th century BC. After being denied access to Egypt, they settled along the pre-existing line that you saw on that map, the coastline there. And they had a decided military and economic advantage in that they learned how to use iron and how to make iron. So they could make much better weapons. And you'll see throughout, it's kind of interesting, again, bringing in our times, constantly when they're being ruled by the Philistines, they tell them they can't make any implements to farm with. They have to farm with, you know, wooden axes and all. They're not allowed, because what you want to do is keep weaponry out of the hands of the people you're ruling. So we'll see that play out in our own nation. So
gun control.
There you go. All right. So we'll go to 1 Samuel 1. There was a certain man of Ramathah-Zophim, and if I pronounce these, I'm sure you can find somebody that does them right, in the country of Ephraim, whose name was Elkanah, the son of Jeroham, the son of Eu, the son of Tohu, the son of Zuph, an Ephraimite. All right, so I went, you know how I enjoy kind of going back and researching the names a little bit. So we have to research this backwards, in that the guy that's the last in line is actually the great-great-grandfather. So the great-great-grandfather, his name, which would be Zup, means honeycomb. And according to, and he's in Chronicles, and he was a Levite, which is going to be very, very important, because it kind of gets lost, because at the end they're called Ephraimites, but Samuel becomes a priest. So that wouldn't have been allowed. That would have been a violation of the law, in that the tribe of Eli was supposed to be the prophets. So his name, again, he was a Levite. He had a son, Tohu, whose name means wasteness. That which is laid waste, desert, emptiness, vanity, nothing. So his son was named Worthless. So you're going to kind of see the history of the country here in this little, quick little name thing. So we went from a priest who had a son that was worthless. Elihu, his name means he is God. So you see a kind of restoration, that they start to understand who is God. Then his father, or his son, Jeroham, means cherished, one who finds mercy. And then Elkanah, his name means God, the zealous, or the zeal of God. So we see a restoration there just in the names of the people that get to Samuel, just in his lineage. So I thought that was kind of interesting. And here we go with the ever interesting. And he had two wives, period. So you know there's going to be trouble, right?
Yeah.
And the name of one was Hannah, and the name of the other was Phinehas. Phinehas, however, had children, but Hannah had no children. And if you understand that culture, to have children was to be blessed by God. It was, being an agricultural society, having children to help you out on the farm is very, very, very important. So not having any children, you are definitely kind of an outcast. But this guy, Elkanah, the more I studied this, the more I kind of really enjoyed this guy and really enjoyed this character that I just kind of read through quickly when you're reading through the Bible and never really, you know, sat down and look at, you know, people are people. They can constantly make bad decisions or good decisions or, and this guy seems to be a really decent character. So now this man used to go up year by year from his city to worship and sacrifice to the Lord of hosts at Shiloh. So that was where the ark was and where the priests were. Where the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas. So if you know, we're priests of the Lord. That's kind of interesting. These two guys are characters. They're horrible. Horrible, horrible people representing God to the people. But this guy is not letting that stand between him and the law and keeping what's supposed to be done right. So on the day when Elkanah sacrificed, he would give portions to Peninnah, his wife, and all of her sons and daughters. But to Hannah, he gave a double portion because he loved her. So here's this guy, you know. Again, God never said have two wives. I believe his ultimate thing with Adam and Eve was one man and one woman. But, you know, he didn't forbid it, so people went out and did it. But this guy seems to have really, he's being a godly man, he's doing what he's supposed to. He's taking care of his first wife, and he knows the pain and suffering of his second wife. So he's reaching after her. He's showing her that he loves her and what she means. And it says, but to Hannah he gave a double portion because he loved her, though the Lord had closed her womb. So that's kind of an interesting context here that it's put in that the Lord, it's not just saying because she can't have kids, it says the Lord had closed her womb. And her rival, obviously the other wife, used to provoke her grievously to irritate her because the Lord had closed her womb. So now here you have this where obviously the husband has a special, special love for Hannah. And his other wife is probably jealous, but she has the kids. So the scab she gets to pick at as, he might love you more, but I got the kids. You know, the inheritance is going to be mine. So this seems to be, you know, this kind of, it had to be a horrible way to live in the house. And so it went on year by year. As often as they went up to the house of the Lord, she used to provoke her. Therefore, Hannah wept and would not eat. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, Hannah, why do you weep and why do you not eat? And why is your heart sad? And am I not more to you than 10 sons? So he's making the best effort he can. You can argue that, you know, maybe he's not helping the situation, but he's trying. He's trying to say, I love you. You know, I don't care that you're not having kids. I love you. And, man, I can be better to you than 10 sons were. Well, then, so then after they had eaten and drunk in Shiloh, Hannah rose. Now Eli, the priest, was sitting on the seat beside the doorpost of the temple. So she was deeply distressed and prayed to the Lord and wept bitterly. And I guess, Scott, I'll let you bring up your point that you brought to me this morning about. I
thought it was interesting her reaction compared to Naomi. Because she went out and then she said, call me Mara, because the Lord dealt with me. She was bitter. And so here, she actually, you know, took the bitterness to the Lord.
And I just think that's a really good point that, you know, God, I don't think he ever expects you to get through life and not be bitter about stuff. But it's like everything. It's how you handle the situation is everything. Anything can happen to anybody in life, but how you handle it. And it looks like in this case, she did what she's supposed to. She took it to the Lord. She's bitter. She's hurt. Somebody's getting a poke at her. And she just takes it before the Lord. And she vowed a vow and said to the Lord of hosts, If you indeed look on your affliction of your servant and remember me and not forget your servant, but I will give your servant a son, then I will give him to the Lord all the days of his life, and no razor shall touch his head. So who does this remind you of?
Samson.
But here it's kind of interesting that the angel of the Lord came to Samson's parents and said, this is what you will do. And he never really took it to heart. You don't see. He just was like, well, whatever. This seems to be her reaching out to God and making a vow to him. And this becomes very, very important to her. So as she continued praying before the Lord, Eli observed her mouth. Hannah was speaking in her heart, and only her lips moved, and her voice was not heard. Therefore, Eli took her to be a drunken woman. I think it's kind of interesting here that the priest of the Lord has not seen true worship enough to recognize it when he's seeing true worship. He's blaming it on, and you got to kind of think to Pentecost, when everybody started speaking in tongues and speaking in languages, and they said, oh, it's only 9 in the morning. Are these guys drunk already? And they're like, no, we're not drunk. So people are not programmed to recognize true worship. And here it shows you how little Eli, who's the high priest, has seen of this. So I think it's just a testament on a conviction of him and the country as a whole. So then Eli said to her, how long will you go on being drunk? Put your wine away from you. Again, so he doesn't recognize worship. He considers her drunk. But Anna answered, no, my Lord, I am a woman troubled in spirit. I have drunk neither wine nor strong drink, but I have been pouring out my soul before the Lord. Do not regard your servant as a worthless woman. For all along, I have been speaking out of my great anxiety and vexation. So she's telling him, hey, I'm bringing my heart completely to the Lord. I'm just laying it all on the line. You know, he should have recognized that, but obviously he hasn't seen it much. So then Eli realizes kind of the error of his ways, and he said, and he answered, go in peace, for the God of Israel grant you your petition that you have made to him. And she said, let your servant find favor in your eyes. Then the woman went her way and ate, and her face was no longer sad. So you can see here, she took the words of Eli as a blessing from God. She said, yeah, this is, so all she brought it to the Lord. Somebody that wasn't even thinking she was doing this thing, when he realized what she was doing, he, you know, said, hey, the Lord's going to grant you what you're, may the Lord grant you your petition. He's not assuming God will. But she takes that as, hey, I'm good with this. And no matter what the outcome was, she went away, she was happy, she had something to eat, and she was no longer sad. So it's really interesting if you can bring, you know, all your heartfelt anxiety and all your troubles to the Lord, what he can do with that. And that's what a tough thing to do as a human. It is tough to just bring it and not lock it up inside you and live with it, as opposed to just dump it out and see what comes of it.
But the other thing is how many times in your life have you looked for something from God? Wonder, is he really, I'm praying for this, and is he answering my prayer? And you read something, you see something, you hear something, and you know it's just a little reassurance God's giving you that says, hey, I hear your prayer. And
yep,
that's the total.
Agreed. And sometimes, I mean, I know it's a country song, but some of the greatest gifts are unanswered prayers.
Yeah.
Because a little while later, you find out, wow, what I was praying for, it ended up being not what I was supposed to have, and God blessed me by not giving that to me. So, it's interesting. You just have, that's the whole faith bit of thinking, he has your best interest at heart. That he, you know, as a parent, I was just discussing this last night with somebody, like, your kids grow up and it's just, you did it to your parents. Somehow you've got this mindset that you want to have fun or do things, and your parents are standing in your way. And it's like, as a parent, you're like, you couldn't be happier than when your kids are happy and when they're doing good things. And you are just there to protect them from the things that are going to hurt them and the bad decisions in life. But to them, that looks like you're just, you know, killing their fun and not letting them do what their friends can do and all this. And it's like, you know, we're the same way before the Lord, the exact same way. We're like, you know, sometimes, what a killjoy. I really wanted, you know, that to come through in my life, and we were going to do this, and it just didn't work out. And again, a couple years later, you're like, oh, my goodness, I'm glad that did not happen, because then this would have not happened, and this. So they rose early in the morning and worshiped before the Lord, back to verse 19. And they went back to their house at Ramah. And Elkanah knew his wife, and the Lord remembered her. And in due time, Hannah conceived and bore a son, and she called his name Samuel. For she said, I have asked from the Lord. So his name means God has heard, or the name of God. So she names him. Obviously, we see through that. You know, again, Ruth, to your question, I don't know if kids live up to their name or they get the name after they, but, I mean, can you imagine naming your son Worthless? But that's interesting. But so here she names him, you know, God heard my petition, and here's his child. So the man Elkanah and all his house went up to offer the Lord their yearly sacrifice and to pay his vow. So he's doing his thing. But Hannah did not go up, for she said to her husband, as soon as the child is weaned, I will bring him so that he may appear in the presence of the Lord and dwell there forever. And Elkanah, her husband, said to her, do what seems best to you. That's just really, really interesting that this guy is like so in tune and so loves his wife and keeps his vows and does this, that he's like, you know, that was another helper for whatever, the farm or whatever he had, or another son to be proud of, and all this. And she's saying, well, you know, I made a vow. I got to give him to God. And he's like, okay, you made that vow. Go ahead. You can keep it. So I just like this character in the book. He kind of comes and goes, but he's really neat. I've ever really sat down and looked at him throughout, and the decisions he could have made if, you know, if he just said no, or if been an evil man, or, you know, whatever. But he seems to be right in tune with her and right in tune with the Lord. So do what seems best to you. Wait until you have weaned him. Only may the Lord establish his word. So that is an interesting prophecy that he's saying, you know, the Lord's going to say, you made a vow, you're keeping your side, so let the Lord, through this incident, establish his word. You want to bring up your phone? So you know, he kind of utters a prophecy here to say, hey, and we know, you know, obviously we know kind of somewhat of the book, that the Lord is going to establish great things through Samuel. So it's pretty interesting that
I wouldn't mind saying a little bit about it.
Go ahead. How about it, brother?
New King James takes out May, so it says, only let the Lord establish his word. I think it's really important. A lot of times we run to look to someone else to go, but he's given us his word that we might know him and that he would settle us. He says, I tell you beforehand, so what happened, you know, with me. And to constantly live in a place where I want to hear and get, may the Lord establish. Because I don't, if I establish something and to her, then if it goes wrong, it's my fault. If it goes right, I look great. But if, as the Lord establishes things in your life, there's no, you can't look left or right. You keep your eyes on Him. And so I just think it's something to remember that, Lord, you gotta make this, and you got to do this work in me.
And it's astounding how many of you have ever kind of prepared for less, and you kind of, I just listen for like a whole week. I'll just listen to different people teaching on it, and I'm like weighing, you know, what I feel like the Lord's telling me from what they're, and there's some really, really great teachers that I love, you know, 90% of the time, which when I was a young Christian and I started in my spirit disagreeing with what this guy said, I was like grieved, and I couldn't handle that in a sense because I thought this guy was just, and then you'll hear somebody else with another take on that, and you're thinking, I think I like what this guy. And I think the Lord, through that, if you can just work through that and let the Lord deal with you. And I used to drive an hour to work every morning. And I have argued with God, not argued with him, but like over some piece of scripture, I have argued and wrestled with the Lord all the way to church. I mean, all the way to work. Like, you know, no, it doesn't mean this. Yes, it does. No, it don't. And I go back and forth, and eventually the Lord just, you know, kind of breaks through that cloudness and says, and he's willing, if you're willing to wrestle, just like Jacob, if you're willing to wrestle through this, he's willing to come out in the end and tell you, this is what I want you to know. This is how I want you to feel. And there's nothing wrong with disagreeing. There's nothing wrong with sitting in church and somebody speaking, and I don't have to fight with them. I don't have, but I'm just like, nah, I see that a little differently. And we can all accept, you know, there's some tenets of Christian faith that you can't let go of. But there's a lot of, you know, I just remember seeing guys. I went to a pastor's conference one time, and these guys were like 5 in the morning. They're fighting over, you know, speaking in tongues or whatever. And I'm like, I just want to sleep for another 15 minutes. Stop. You know, it means nothing in the great grand. You believe in it, great. You don't, whatever. I don't think the Lord cares if your heart's in the right place. And eventually he's going to show, you know, show somebody something. So just stop fighting, and it doesn't look good in the world, and I've seen, you know, you see people fussing out in public about things, and it just doesn't look good to the world. And so there's some things that I think we should, you know, I think that's part of when Paul said, look, you're bringing these arguments before judges, you know, and don't you realize you're going to judge angels one day? And here you're fighting in Denny's, you know, over a scripture. Stop it. You know, you look bad. It's not a good representation of God. So that's Chris's soapbox for the day.
I don't agree.
So the woman, obviously Hannah, she remained and nursed her son until she weaned him. And when she weaned him, she took him up along with her 3-year-old bull, an ephah of flour, a skin of wine, and she brought him to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. So she's bringing all the offerings that you would bring. And the child was young, so it doesn't tell you how young he was, but, I mean, to just be off of weaning, I would assume he's pretty young. Then they slaughtered the bull, and they brought the child to Eli, and he said, and she said, oh, my Lord, as you live, my Lord, I am the woman who was standing here in your presence praying to the Lord. For this child I prayed, and the Lord has granted me a petition, and I made to him. Therefore, I have lent him to the Lord. It's kind of interesting versus that I kind of thought of, lent him to the Lord. It says given, there's different, you know, even the Hebrews sometimes say it's lent. But she's basically saying, I'm giving up him to the Lord, and as long as he lives, he is lent to the Lord. And like I said, that word can be given, that word. So she's basically turned him over, and he worshiped the Lord there. So, you know, she's fulfilling her vows. She's, you know, it had to be a painful, on one hand, it had to be a painful thing. On the other hand, we're talking about how you can cry out to the Lord. It must have been awesome for her to realize the God of the universe heard your petition. And, you know, think how much this changed her relationship at home with her husband, with her sister-wife, whatever you want to call her. doesn't call him a concubine, says the two wives. And however this plays out, this is just, and what's kind of interesting here, you don't know how long this has been, but you find out later she has other children. So you don't know if she had children in the meantime while she was going through this, you know, as he was getting old enough to be. I'm sure the priest didn't want to change diapers and stuff, so I'm sure he was old enough to, you know, get out of that little phase of life. So, anybody had any? I'm going to try to go a little faster than one chapter a week, because this is, it's a big book. So,
did you ever look at it from Eli's point?
As far as?
He first assumes that she's drunk in temple. Then he realized, you know, not, he had no idea. He just assumed. And then he realizes he made a mistake, not knowing, and he accepted it. And now a child brought to him that he never thought was going to happen. And I think it's a thing for Eli to look at, because knowing the story ahead, is what happened with this child versus what happened with his children.
Oh, yeah.
And it's very strong that it's a sign that she's giving her child to the Lord, but yet Eli wouldn't even correct his children. So it's unbelievable how the Lord's showing him how things should be, and does he accept it?
Right, and Samuel ends up being a total contrast to his two sons.
Correct.
They're totally, and so, you know, you just, as a parent, there's always those joyful moments when you see your kids make a decision, or you've made a decision as family or something, and you see it just blessed, and you're like, oh, you know, because you make so many missteps going through life. And God just has to, you know, work through. You get to make your choices. You don't get to choose your consequences. So, you know, sometimes that's a heavy burden. But the Lord's always going to be there, but there's still going to be consequences. He rarely gets you out of the consequences of your decisions. And but he'll get you through the consequences of your decision. Anybody else?
Sign that weaning
usually women didn't nurse 3 to 5 years, and he was, you know, he was probably, you know, closer to 5 than. Right. So again, not the biology of it, but she might have had another child in the middle of that. And again, you'll see later that she's blessed with a couple kids that, you know, the Lord, you know. Like, she kept her vow, and he's like, okay, I just, you know, you can see here, looking again, hindsight, it says, and the Lord closed her womb, because he had a plan. And just like you said, she became a witness to Eli, that, you know, here he hadn't seen true worship, so he makes a mistake. He sees it, he prophesies over it, the child's here, and now the child's going to be a testament against him and his family. And ultimately bring about destruction. He doesn't bring it about, but he'll actually tell Eli, destruction's coming. So,
I think it's pretty cool that she turns around and says to Eli, because Eli said, may the Lord grant petitions, and she saw that the Lord granted the petitions in my heart. And that's even should have been an encouragement to him, like, hey,
right. So you don't know if he's like 3 years later, like, who the heck is this? Like, and she's like, well, here's the kid you promised. And so I don't know. It doesn't specific.
It doesn't even say that he ever knew what she prayed.
Yeah.
Right. It just says, may the Lord give you the petition.
Grant you, and then here it is.
Guess what? Anybody else? All right, anybody volunteer to close us, or I'll just close us.